You think, then, that America's intellectual leadership has collapsed?
Yes, collapsed and abdicated.
Oh, how have the intellectuals failed to do the things that they ought to do? How have they not lived up to their responsibilities?
By betraying the very premise that made their existence possible, by denying the intellect. For decades now, the intellectuals have been progressively preaching and advocating the idea that the intellect is impotent, that man can know nothing for certain, that reason is unreliable, and in effect, man has no power to know the facts of reality. This amounts to men who, proclaiming themselves intellectual, spend their time denying the validity of the intellect. That is a form of committing suicide. And today, when you see the rise of such openly mystical, anti-intellectual philosophies as Zen Buddhism or existentialism, doctrines which cannot really properly be called philosophies, this is the admission of intellectual bankruptcy on the part of those who accept it. If in a group of men, such a theory as Zen Buddhism, which is a doctrine originating about the 5th century BC, if that becomes the latest word of the mind, it isn't I who am condemning them. They have condemned themselves by their own actions. They have given up. They have declared their intellectual bankruptcy and have gone back to the mysticism of the Dark Ages.
Why do you think they've done this?
Because since philosophers are the ones who really set the basic premises of the whole intellectual profession, the philosophies of the Western world have been going progressively more and more towards mysticism ever since the Renaissance. The Renaissance was achieved, was the intellectual result of the Aristotelian influence of Aristotle's philosophy, which in effect destroyed the Middle Ages and broke the way for the Renaissance. But ever since then, while men, while the culture in general, were achieving incredible progress, culminating in the 19th century, on the basis of that Aristotelian influence, the intellectuals, ever since Immanuel Kant, were going progressively more and more against reason. The trend started, of course, before Kant, but I consider Kant the crucial destroyer and the crucial turning point. He was the philosopher who undercut the validity of reason. He did not really succeed, but his is the most skillful system of pushing reason off the philosophical scene altogether. And to the extent to which other philosophers and intellectuals accepted his basic premises, to that extent they have been moving towards a noumenal, mystical world ever since.
Okay, everybody, we're doing a show.
There are a lot of very fine first-rate minds in here, but by my experience in this building, none of you have ever been taught the tools by which your mind can work easier on the information that you get from the outside world. We concentrate on ideas and the structure of how people think. So memorizing things and writing it down on a test never happens in here at all. It doesn't happen once. You may have tests, but they won't have anything to do with paper and pencil. And you begin to understand how to use these tools, you will have taken a giant step forward to being a powerful, independent human being.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to School Sucks Live. Today is October the 18th. I'm Brett, glad to be back with you. And on the show with me tonight, our old friend, the oldest friend of the podcast, Wes Bertrand. How you doing, Wes?
Doing well, Brett. Yeah, back in our day, we used to do podcasts together.
Wow, you sound old.
Like 08, wasn't it, when we first started?
We started at the very end of 2008 in December. I wrote to you and I said, how can I audition to be on this Complete Liberty podcast?
Let's slay the education beast.
Yeah, we went at it for like 6 to 8 hours, I think, that whole series turned out to be. We started a series months ago, and we've been slowly chipping away at it on School Sucks Podcast called Logic Saves Lives. And I picked this title after I had been doing some research for a series of shows called The American Way, research about a group of folks called the Nazis and the mysticism and collectivism that took over their culture starting in the mid-1800s, but really accelerating very quickly through the end of that century and up into the 1930s and 1940s. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people died as a result of that. And it was a culture that for centuries had abandoned logic, if never introduced to it at all. They didn't really have much of an enlightenment in Central Europe, which was dominated throughout most of the Middle Ages and beyond by the Holy Roman Empire. The series started with Richard Grove and Tony Myers from TragedyandHope.com. We talked about the empowering value of understanding some of this stuff. Wes was in the second episode of that series, where we talked about attitudes and values and how to present and explain these things to other people. Before the series even began, I did two previews, one on this Mitt Romney character, who is now the Republican nominee for president of the United States, if you care about such things, and another one on a viral video called Coney 2012. And since then, we've done a couple of episodes. The series has been pretty popular, and I do have to say that I think we have maybe as many as 2,000 or 3,000 new regular listeners to the show. I don't know how that happened. I wish I knew how these things happened, because I would do whatever that thing was more. But welcome. I hope you're enjoying this so far. I hope you're finding it entertaining and educational. That is the goal, or the two goals of this show. But we are continuing. And in fact, when Wes and I did the second episode of this series, Logic Saves Lives, Wes, you said it was important to get back and do the stolen concept fallacy, which we are going to be talking about tonight. Now, at first, when we give a basic introduction to this, it might seem to some to be somewhat inconsequential. But when I think we can tie it to Immanuel Kant and the impact of German idealism, the philosophy of Central Europe in the 19th century, and to see the impact that that had on the entire world in the 20th century and continuing right up to present day America, it is a very, very significant piece of false logic.
Yeah, it asks us to really look at how our mind works, right?
Hume's attack on inductive reasoning awoke the genius of the 18th century Prussian philosopher Immanuel Kant. Kant, roused from his dogmatic slumbers, launched himself on a program to integrate the subjectivity inherent in Hume's view with a theory that could incorporate the unknowability of the world in itself. Kant sought to close the gap between the rationalist and empiricist traditions by synthesizing them into a single, coherent thesis.
Kant certainly saw himself as coming at a pivotal position, and he thought he recognized defects in both the rationalist and the empiricist traditions. Indeed, to some extent, he defined those two traditions in order to explain the defects in both and to synthesize what was true in the two of them, to use one of his own favorite words.
With one bold stroke, Kant turned the tables on Hume, asserting that while we can't derive causality from experience, the fact that we have such a mental framework is vitally important. The fact is, we all share these categories of experience. So while causality may not exist out there in the world, what matters is that we all still experience the world in the same way. The mind makes the world, not the other way around.
Kant prided himself on what he called the Copernican revolution in philosophy, the idea that that actually the mind structures the way reality can appear to us, and then in a sense reality has to conform to the laws of the mind rather than the mind trying to discover what laws of reality are, which are completely external to it. Kant put the mind in a different relation to reality than any of his predecessors. His predecessors had thought of the mind as a passive observer of reality, and had sort of looked around for some kind of guarantee that it was a good passive observer of reality.
Kant was a master at drawing distinctions. One pre-existing distinction he affirmed was between a priori judgments, which are based on reason, and a posteriori judgments based on experience. A priori judgments, such as 2 plus 2 equals 4, are necessarily true, while a posteriori judgments, this car is red or today it is raining, are contingent, forever tied to the circumstances of experience. Kant made a further crucial distinction between analytic and synthetic judgments. Analytic judgments take the form of sentences that have predicates which are wholly contained in their subjects, such as, all bachelors are unmarried. Synthetic judgments have predicates that are distinct from their subjects. Kant used the example, all bodies are heavy. Thus, they add something that we didn't already know to the subject. Then, in a sharp break with his predecessors, Kant proposed we need to consider all four possible kinds of judgment: analytic a posteriori, synthetic a posteriori, analytic a priori, and synthetic a priori. Since all a posteriori judgments are synthetic, an analytic a posteriori judgment is not a real possibility. Further, he asserted that synthetic a priori judgments not only are possible, but in fact serve as the foundation for mathematics and natural science.
Kant's innovation was, in technical terms, was to think that there was such a thing, and that he could demonstrate there to be such a thing as synthetic but a priori knowledge. That is, knowledge that goes beyond the concepts involved, or knowledge, I mean, more precisely, knowledge that a predicate applies to objects which is not already implied by the subject concept, but which yet can be known to be true universally and necessarily, and therefore must somehow be known to be true independently of experience.
That a straight line between two points is the shortest is a synthetic proposition. For my concept of straight contains no notion of quantity, but only of quality. The concept of shortest is thus wholly an addition, and it cannot be derived by any analysis from the concept of a straight line. Intuition must, therefore, lend its aid here, by means of which alone is this synthesis possible.
Kant took his radical notion of a priori synthetic judgments and applied it to aesthetics, ethics, and political philosophy. In moral philosophy, he put forth what he called the categorical imperative, a proposition to rationally guide our actions. Act in such a way that the maxim of your action can be willed as a universal law.
Kant's ethics is based on the idea that we simply apply rationality to action, and when we do that, we see that we should act in universally valid ways, universally acceptable ways, and that actions are wrong if the success of the proposed action depends upon making an exception of yourself.
For Kant, the autonomy of the will was the guiding principle for all moral laws and for all duties stemming from them. It is the guarantee of man's dignity and his equality under the law.
At the most basic level, Kant's moral philosophy leads to a liberal political philosophy because he believes that there's a natural connection between freedom of choice and freedom of action. And if one ought to be free to choose one's objectives and to choose one's way of life, then one also ought to be free to act upon that choice.
Kant believed that reason can't leapfrog beyond the world of experience to the world in itself. Metaphysics, however, consists of a set of propositions on what lies beyond our experience. As a result, Kant declared that metaphysics was impossible. And so the stage was set for an eruption of philosophy in response to Kant, beginning with Hegel and continuing through the analytic and continental traditions. What began as an effort to shake off the scholasticism of the Middle Ages initiated a chain reaction of thought that extends to this very day. And as diverse as the philosophies that comprise the modern era may be, there is an undercurrent that unites them. A fundamental faith in the human capacity to figure things out.
Throughout history, there have been lots of people, philosophers included, especially probably, telling us that we really can't trust our own judgment in these things. We need to defer to other people's statements about reality to guide us. I took a logic class in college, and I didn't learn anything of the sort that we're talking about. But I did hear the professor say things like, we can't know things for certain. There is no absolute truth. There is no objective reality. Those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear any of those things in academia?
Oh, yeah. I took only one philosophy course, I think, throughout my entire college education, but that was certainly one of the themes. And why do you think that is? Why do you think that idea is so popular?
Yeah, I mean, Rand described these erroneous philosophies as systems of rationalization. So when someone is purporting something like that, it's usually to try to either assuage a fear or get some sort of need met, you know, to avoid some painful truth, perhaps. You know, it depends on the context, of course, but typically, I mean, if they were to embrace the idea of objective reality and logical thinking in terms of the art and process of non-contradictory identification, you know, maybe their way of life would be in jeopardy, perhaps. The things that they're teaching would have to change, obviously. And the support structure, you know, the statism is really involved in education, you know, from kindergarten on up to grad school. So all that stuff would have to be dramatically changed if they embrace these simple truths.
Sure. And just for new people, if somebody's joining us and they didn't hear the beginning of this series, or they haven't heard past episodes of my show or yours, can we just redefine objective versus subjective?
Sure. So obviously, when someone says there's no such thing as objectivity, objectivity is a concept that only makes sense in relation to subjectivity. So, and subjectivity only makes sense in relation to objectivity. So they're kind of a polar opposites, if you will, but they're also contextual because objective thinking takes place in reality. So we have these metaphysical concepts of reality, consciousness, and identity. Those are the three axiomatic things that really are involved in everything we do and say, right? And the folks that say everything's subjective, they just want to have the consciousness part. But consciousness really can't be conceived of if it's not distinct from something from which it arises or where it takes place, right? Mm-hmm. And that would be objective reality. So objectivity is our mind's ability to relate to that reality. And it can be an inner world too. I mean, that's the subjectivity part of it. We experience emotions and pleasures and just basically feelings within us that other people can't see, can't relate to. But when we talk about these things, then they can relate to them because we're making them objectively known. And all the things that we see and do in the world is based on this idea that there is a reality that's distinct from our own subjective awareness. So if any one of us dies or perishes, we lose all those sensations, the person that perished did, but everyone else keeps on chugging along and is aware of that reality still. So it doesn't vanish with consciousness, even though it may seem that way.
So this is about trusting the input objective reality from our five senses.
Yeah. And of course, this is the conundrum, right, for philosophers to grapple with throughout the centuries is, can you trust your senses? Because if they say that it's just subjective senses that are always separate from that objective realm, like Plato and Kant said that we can't know the real reality, we can just sort of see the shadows on the wall, right, in Plato's cave. Sort of projections of the ideal forms, they're always out of our grasp because our senses taint our view of reality, but that's really not conceiving of our mechanism of understanding the world in an objective way, because objectivity, it's defined as, from objectivism's terms, to our own ability to relate to reality in an objective way. I know I use the word in the definition, but to relate to reality in a way that's conceptual, that basically identifies the mind making an observation in reality and connecting the two, essentially. So our minds are always part of reality, obviously, but they're also distinct from reality. So this is obviously can get really confusing in the hallowed halls of academia, right?
Sure. Now, just to add some depth to this, you mentioned Plato, right? Now, Plato was part of this other debate on the rationalist versus empiricist. So Plato would be considered a rationalist, where you cannot trust the empirical side so much. And I never understood why there was this divide between the two. I think being born in the 1970s and the first real philosophical ideas that I was introduced to with any kind of depth was objectivism. So after you know that, this debate that raged for centuries seems kind of silly, but there was a real divide between rationalism and empiricism. And when you mention Immanuel Kant, his philosophy of idealism seemed to say, well, the rationalists were saying, well, you cannot trust the senses, and the empiricists basically said, you know, you cannot trust your mind to make meaning out of everything. Kant said, well, geez, you can't trust either. And that's how this big gray area was created, correct? Of German idealism.
Yeah, it's hard to understand if you really start going into the philosophical stuff and reading, you know, the firsthand accounts from these philosophers, rather than just, you know, scholarly treatises on what they said. I mean, it's really hard to find clarity in that realm and comprehensibility. And if you read Ayn Rand, it's kind of the opposite. I mean, she really doesn't mince words. She is very forthright and distinct and clear in her message. So if you take a philosophy class and you get a PhD in philosophy, I mean, I would guess that if you line up 10 people that have PhDs in philosophy, they have 10 different opinions on who said what about what.
Sure. Right?
So, but I think the general gist is there, is what you said. I mean, Kant is an interesting character. Stefan Molyneux talked about him in his closing speech here at Libertopia last weekend. And he was basically talking about how Kant has the principle of universality. So whatever you do needs to be universally applicable to everyone else. So it kind of rids the world of those contradictions that I can do this for me, but it doesn't apply for you. And that would be the, you know, like the exception of statism, right? That it's okay for people calling themselves government to violate individual rights, but not for individuals. So if you take just Kant from that perspective of universality, that would seem to be quite logical. However, Kant also purported things like an ethics of duty, that you should do something only, I mean, something is most ethical when you have no interest in doing it whatsoever, kind of thing. Like, he takes the self-sacrifice meme all the way to the very end.
Yeah.
And so that ethics of duty or obligation to other people rather than to yourself is the exact opposite of what Ayn Rand portrayed. And then, you know, the whole noumenal and phenomenal worlds that we can, you know the world through our senses and so forth. But this other world of abstractions is kind of ethereal and not graspable in a coherent, logical way. So, yeah, it's a huge mixed bag with Kant. And I know objectivists have railed against him ever since Rand did. But some others have seen some points of light in his reasoning. And you can find points of light in all these different philosophies. But at the end of the day, are they using logic? Are they ferreting out the contradictions? Are they defining their terms and tracing these abstractions all the way back to reality?
Yeah.
And understanding that, you know, all we have is our senses to make sense of anything. And if you say our senses are untrustworthy, well, in point of fact, you're using your senses to make that determination. And that's why we know about, you know, hallucinations and mirages and things like that, where our senses seemingly are giving us a distorted view of the world. But in principle, we can't have a distorted view of the world, because in order to make that determination requires use of our senses. See, so it's a preconceptual equivalent to what's necessary to understanding things.
And I want to point out that we're not doing protagonists and antagonists of the history of philosophy here either. And you brought that up by saying, you know, there are points of light in all of these various bodies of work. So that is true with Kant. That is true with Georg Hegel. That is true with Nietzsche. And these were people who were observing the time in which they lived. Obviously, hindsight is 2020 to look back at these philosophies and see the impact that they had on the modern world and judge them accordingly. But we're not doing good guys and bad guys. I want that to be clear. But what you spoke of, Kant's categorical imperative, that universally applicable, you know, what you do should make a rule for everybody idea, mm-hmm. combined with these other ideas, does show evidence, and we can say this objectively, that he did not remove contradictions from his entire body of work. And I'm sure we're all guilty of that somewhere if we've, you know, said enough things or wrote enough things. But I think that is a point of importance that you brought up there, that there are some major contradictions in his work. And today, I mean, one of the reasons why we're talking about Kant is he set out to use reason to disprove the validity of reason, which is the stolen concept.
Yeah, the fallacy of self-exclusion, right?
Yeah.
Using a term or a concept in the process of trying to refute it. And that's the essence of the stolen concept fallacy, where you're denying the genetic roots, if you will, of the idea in your attempt to persuade people that it is an invalid idea or an incorrect term or whatever.
There's one quote that I like too that I was looking at earlier from Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology by Ayn Rand. When modern philosophers declare that axioms are a matter of arbitrary choice and proceed to choose complex derivative concepts as the alleged axioms of their alleged reasoning, one can observe that their statements imply and depend on existence, consciousness, and identity, which they profess to negate, but which are smuggled into their arguments in the form of unacknowledged, stolen concepts. So all of these postulates require the very thing that much of modern philosophy professes to disprove, or not disprove, but just say you can't even know. It's not even there.
Mm-hmm.
And just some examples of this, if you are unfamiliar with the stolen concept before today, there are absolutely no absolutely true statements, or there are absolutely no absolutes. It is impossible for people to communicate with each other. I do not exist, and physics has proven science is incapable of telling us anything true. All examples of stolen concepts. And somebody in the chat writes, the first stolen concept I learned was property is theft.
Yeah, that was the French political theorist, right?
Yeah.
Proudhon.
French anarchist.
Mm-hmm.
All property is theft. And
yeah, I'm guessing he leans to the left in the anarchy realm.
It's way safe, left. Safe assumption. And I just wanted to share with the audience this quote from Nathaniel Brandon, who we're going to be talking about in the show later today. He says in response to this statement, theft is a concept that logically depends on the antecedent concept of rightfully owned property and refers to the act of taking that property without the owner's consent. If no property is rightfully owned, that is, if nothing is property, there can be no such concept as theft. Thus, the statement all property is theft has an internal contradiction. To use the concept theft while denying the validity of the concept of property is to use theft as a concept to which one has no logical right, that is, as a stolen concept.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you think folks took this guy seriously when he said something like that? Was he tapping into some sort of emotional yearning within the folks when they hear something like that?
You know, blame and victimization, easy things, right? So I the quote is totally out of context for me, but if it's directed at the owners or controllers of capital, you could see that maybe people who are poor or downtrodden would find something like that to be very appealing.
Have the thought that they're not getting their fair share kind of thing?
Yep.
Well, I think, you know, there is that meme still existing in our culture that people aren't getting their fair share.
Yeah,
that
there's absolutely
equality imbalances in the culture, and boy, it's government's job to fix it, right?
Yeah.
That's why, you know, progressive taxation is based on this idea.
Well, it also empowers the government by redefining the hierarchy of values in society. Like, so our value is not freedom. Our value is fairness, you know? Mm. So what we have to do is ensure fairness. And that's a kind of or equality. I mean, these are kind of made up things.
Wouldn't they be considered stolen concepts as well?
How so?
Interesting, isn't it? Maybe they would be what Rand called anti-concepts or package deals. Not sure, but basically when they say we need fairness and we need to use force to enforce fairness, right, that would be contradictory. Because what is fairness? Fairness relies on the fact that human beings make their own choices, that they own their own selves and property, and that they engage in voluntarily consensual agreements, you know? So to say that we're going to, you know, level the playing field with force is dispensing with the very concept that you're trying to, you know, protect or promote in society, which is fairness.
So as a so-called citizen, when they come for you eventually to take your money or your property with guns, you say, don't worry, for the sake of fairness, I'm going to defend myself with a gun that I have. That doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
So I take your point, absolutely.
And when they say this is for the fairness of the common good, right? Always excluding the individual.
Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of concepts being stolen there, as well as, you know, the Justice Department and courts of justice, courts of law, they call them too. You know, the whole idea of justice is based on a process of recognizing each other's individual rights and personal sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
So right off the bat, these folks are in an organization that does not perform acts of justice by extorting them, you know, taxing them and regulating them and imposing laws on them and so forth. So Ayn Rand dealt with that one pretty well with Hank Reardon's talk in the courtroom in Atlas Shrugged. And it's actually in part two of the movie. Part two is out now. So he has a courtroom speech in there. It's pretty true to the words in the book. I just reread that part. But it's definitely a principled stance that he's taking, that he's not recognizing their legitimacy, and he's not going to pretend as if he is voluntarily offering a case in this courtroom, because the courtroom is not based on justice.
Right. And if you want to join our conversation, Wes had an idea before the show that if you've encountered examples of this in your own dealings, we'd like to hear from you and have you share them with us. So if you have any questions about what we've covered so far, best way to reach us is 843-JOIN-SSP. You can Skype in School Sucks Live. And Wes, I wanted to start with an example of yours that you had recently. You were at Libertopia, correct?
I was, and this was actually after Libertopia had ended. We all went to go see Atlas Shrugged Part 2. And one of the folks that was at Libertopia was there, and we talked about the movie afterwards. And he said to me that, essentially from a psychological point of view, humans are creating their own hell for themselves. So all the torment that people have about, you know, the ills of statism, for instance, that we're terribly frustrated about this, you know, dog and pony show, the presidential debates, all that nonsense, and we're getting really upset about it. But this is all self-created stuff, because nothing is really impinging on us directly. And so that led to a discussion of, well, okay, that's interesting. You know, that's constructivism, that we construct our own sort of scripts in life. And we operate on these assumptions, and we have these thoughts that cause these feelings, which is all pretty valid. But he took it a step further to say that human beings are essentially creating their own realities, which is the extreme aspect of constructivism, that it's total subjectivism, that it's actually a primacy of consciousness. And there was a philosopher, Berkeley, I believe, that extolled this one too, just full-on primacy of consciousness, that there really is no objective reality, that each person, everything you see, the road in front of you as you drive your car, you're creating that with your own mind, you know, this kind of stuff.
So
this is obviously the fallacy of stolen concept, is it not?
I don't know, unless you created this man with your own mind.
Yeah, maybe it was all just a figment of my imagination.
Well,
no, that's the thing. It's like it gets you to question your own ability to comprehend reality, right? Fact of the matter is, we were having a conversation. I didn't dream this, and there are other people to corroborate it, you know? So how do you deal with this notion that there is no objective reality from someone's standpoint? You know, obviously, where did he come to this idea? It reminded me of a podcast by Joe Rogan. He was interviewing, what's the guy that wrote Crossing the Rubicon? Michael Rupert, I think the guy's name is.
Yep.
He's kind of a peak oil type of guy. I think he and Alex Jones would get along well, right?
I believe they have gotten along well in the past, yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of fear-mongering stuff. The sky is falling any minute now.
Sure.
So he just recently did a show. I think it was a movie, documentary film, just him basically chain-smoking in his basement, telling the end of the world story from his perspective.
Right.
And he told Joe Rogan, he's like, because he was using these sort of biblical verses and talking about, you know, some things that are going to happen in a sort of mystical way. And Joe's like, so what are you talking about there? And he goes, well, you know, when the state of the world is so effed up and it's just craziness going on out there, you have three choices. You can basically go crazy, go insane with the rest of them. You can commit suicide, or you can become a mystic. And he said, I chose the last one, became a mystic. And that's how he's coping with things. And I suspect this man I was talking to after Atlas Shrugged has used this as a way to cope as well, you know, to basically try to explain the madness of the world and maybe kind of check out on things, because the mysticism stuff takes you into a realm apart from reality. It's just in your imagination, obviously. And if you can conceive the world in that way to make it all kind of fit together and explain things, you know, it's as if you can avoid the real reality of the situation and then not have to take any steps to try to change things in that sort of direct way, perhaps. I'm just speculating. That's kind of the way people, I guess, come to these different stolen concepts in their mind and promote them to other people. Because obviously in this conversation, he was indirectly asking me to doubt my own ability to perceive or conceive of objective reality.
Well, at the same time, relying on
yes.
your ability because you're having this conversation with him.
Yeah, and so the next question naturally is, okay, so how come we can communicate if you're just creating me, you know, what's going on here? And it's really about resonance, Brett.
Yeah. Now, why would he create you?
Our two realities are resonating with each other in such a way that we're both creating the same reality for ourselves.
I don't know why he would create you. You seem like you would be such a nuisance to somebody who believes something like that. Why didn't he create like a 6-year-old?
I didn't get into a disagreeable mode with him. I was just trying to ferret out exactly where he's coming from.
Right.
But yeah, it's interesting how people come to these different notions, huh?
Well, I think that what would you say if somebody brought up arguments about, let's say, the limited spectrum of human hearing or the limited spectrum of human sight, not being able to see infrared or ultraviolet light at either end of the spectrum, not being able to hear certain sounds, an entire chemical world that existed right beneath our noses, a microbiological world that existed right beneath our noses, in some cases in our noses, for so long undetected, that how much more, somebody could say, well, how much more is happening around us that we are entirely unaware of.
Mm-hmm. And to that, I would say, get thee to a scientific lab and figure that shit out.
Yeah, exactly.
It's much more helpful to do it that way than to go off into the mystical realm of just rampant speculation about things that, you know, indulge in the fallacy of soul and concept, for one. But, I mean, we don't know a lot about the universe, but we do know what we know. And that's something to use to build upon itself, right? The hierarchical nature of knowledge and the contextual nature of it. So I think it's just important to give ourselves credit for what we can do, we do and what we do know, and understand that there are somewhat bigger fish to fry than, you know, just sort of arbitrarily postulating things, I guess for the sake of making things more wonderful, perhaps. Maybe that's one of the motives.
More tolerable, maybe.
More tolerable.
Yeah.
Yeah. More magical, if you will. You know, Richard Dawkins has a book, I think it's for kids, talking about the magic of nature, you know, and he's written extensively about evolutionary biology. And it's endlessly fascinating to read about all these different organisms with all these different skills and abilities and just, you know, niches in the ecology and how they've gotten there and, you know, reducing it down to DNA molecules. And you can reduce those down to physics. And it's just, it's amazing. It's better than magic.
Sure.
It's real.
I'm taking a look at our chat, and a couple of people have mentioned quantum physics, and I'm not really sure what the context is.
It says, what the bleep do we know? You ever see that one?
What the bleep do we know was certainly an example of the wonders of this quantum world. And as the title suggests, of course, there is a lot that we cannot know. And the film is basically using science to, in many cases, demonstrate man's ignorance, if I remember it correctly. Now, what's your thought on the impact, even the pop culture impact of quantum physics on the rational world, the objective world?
It is interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, people that are not physicists start talking about energies, right, from a different standpoint than what physicists would say. And yet you've got a whole cottage industry of physicists out there, the quantum physicists, that are funded a lot, you know, like the folks at CERN, the superconducting super collider.
Yeah.
And they're trying to find the God particle and all this stuff with lots of stolen loot, you know? I mean, I'm not sure that the private sector would fund that thing, but maybe, maybe not. It's just that I think it's important for us to realize that physicists have not really studied philosophy in depth, especially objective philosophy. So they can go off on these sort of flights of fancy and start saying things like something, a particle can be itself and not itself at the same time in the same respect, or it can be two places at the same time. It, referring to a particular particle, can be two places at the same time, which is stealing the concept of what a particle is, right?
Yeah.
Because that's a single noun, right? Not plural. So I think it's David Harriman that has written and given lectures about a more objective physics. Folks might want to check that out because he directly addresses a lot of the notions in quantum physics. And some of them are just blatantly contradictory when you look at them through the lens of logic, right? But I think a lot of it is just their interpretations of the experiments rather than the actual data from the experiments itself. I mean, they kind of imbue it with a sort of mysticism, and people take that stuff and then magnify it into the macro realm as, you know, across the board, we live in this mystical universe kind of thing. And you get into like the law of attraction. That's another thing that you hear about. That's kind of what this guy was promoting with the creating your own reality stuff.
I think that's taking something that's kind of based on truth and extending it into a mystical realm. In other words, and I've known people like this who pretty much their default position is woe is me. And boy, you know, it seems like they find bad things to happen to them. And there's nothing magical about it. I think that people who think more positively have a tendency to find the positivity in more things than people who are just waiting for something negative to happen to them because that's what they're comfortable with. There's nothing mm-hmm. magical about it. And I thought that the whole secret was kind of irresponsible in that respect, because in a place where, you know, a person can change their thinking in a way that will affect them positively in life, it kind of turned personal responsibility over to magic, which mm-hmm. it isn't.
And then it pointed the blame on the individual when circumstances were such that the result didn't happen that they wished would have happened.
Mm.
They weren't, I guess, willing it enough or something. Or they were thinking some negative thoughts, and that contributed to it not happening. So it's like, it's a little bit onion peeling to figure out what people's definition of consciousness is and how it relates to reality, objective reality.
Right before you were talking about how the private sector wouldn't fund this experiment, somebody writes in the chat.
The Higgs boson.
Yeah. Why do people in the Liberty Movement not see the state as corporate influence in mainstream science? So mm-hmm. you mentioned stolen money can be used, can distort what the priorities are, you know, and people can get money for this, you know, Peter Venkman kind of Ghostbusters experiments that they do. If you remember at the beginning of that movie, obviously when I was 7, it didn't make any sense to me, but they're getting kicked out of some university and they're like, what are we going to do? We can't go into the private sector. They expect results, you know,
exactly.
And they're basically just doing this kind of pseudo Milgram experiment where Bill Murray is shocking this poor boy while telling this attractive girl she's getting all the right answers, and he's just having them guess the shape that's on a card, and he's being paid government money to do this. And obviously yeah. that's a parody, but there are things probably in that realm of ridiculousness that happened in the real world of academia, for sure.
Oh man, enormous waste and dead ends of research happens in that realm. Endless mouse studies.
So again, if anyone wants to ask a question or share a thought with us, but you don't want to call in, you can type it into this chat. It's where you are if you're listening, schoolsucksproject.com/live. Someone says, pseudoscience is government fact. I'm not sure what that means. I would like an elaboration on that, if that user doesn't mind.
Well, a lot of things, a lot of the so-called facts that government purports is pseudoscience, for sure.
So what are some examples of that?
Strictly pseudoscientific stuff. Well, they've done some research and funding of parapsychological and maybe even paranormal activity. You know, remote viewing, for instance.
Sure.
Pseudoscience. And I think they've done some funding of like acupuncture and so forth, which is based on this pseudoscientific notion of body meridians from ancient Chinese medicine. But the parapsychological stuff is, you know, ESP, clairvoyance, those kinds of things. And that is dropping the context of what consciousness, conceptual consciousness is. It doesn't do those things because it's confined to the neurons in our brain interacting. And the only way to get things done is to use technology when we think these thoughts to do things and communicate things. So it's just a complete side road into mysticism. It's interesting because, you know, Rupert said three things, but what's the fourth alternative? You know, there's going crazy, there's committing suicide, and then there's becoming a mystic. But what's the fourth solid alternative that we're not really taught much in our culture? Well, kind of what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say trying to live in concert with reason, or, you know, at least developing an understanding of it. And I think that that has, you know, an empowering element to it, and taking some control. It's hard. That's hard. I mean, mysticism is easy. Blame is easy. Victimization is much easier than that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, maybe it has a lot to do with the way people are schooled, the way people are treated as children, but hard work that doesn't have money at the end of it is often very unappealing. You know, I think it's associated with pain and boredom and frustration. And even if you look at the markets that have been built up around making life easier in ways that it maybe always shouldn't be, I think that, you know, really trying to understand these things and also, you know, build up a strong personal foundation first before taking on some of these bigger ideas, that can be intimidating, I think.
Yeah, because we're not really given any examples of how to achieve logical clarity in the intellectual realm. I mean, all the intellectuals that are operating in the culture, well, let's say most of them, the majority of them, are operating in a realm that is illogical. So how are they going to lead themselves out of that realm? That's an interesting question. You know, all the mainstream journalists and academics and all this stuff, they're not really seeing the contradictions that they need to see in order to move on with clarity. One of the persons in the chat said the latest study on acupuncture has proven it has an effect outside of placebo. Well, there's a lot of controversy about these studies, and I could give you some links about this. But, you know, when they do sham treatments, it's important to do comparative controlled studies so you can isolate what the causal factor is going on there. But they do sham treatments, which means they put the needles in a different spot than the ancient Chinese medicine body meridian template recommends or mandates, and they get similar effects. So obviously it's not the so-called body meridian thing, which if you ask any physicist will tell you it doesn't exist, those kind of energies. But I know people want to find helpful things in all these modalities, all these alternative therapies. And placebo effect does have an effect, obviously. You know, it can be very beneficial to go to treatment from someone who's really caring and showing you this sort of acceptance and warmth that you may not be getting in your everyday life. And I think that's why people go to chiropractic medicine and acupuncture and a whole litany of things. I mean, even Nathaniel Brennan has mentioned the energy therapies. One of his friends, Roger Callahan, was an exponent or founder of thought field therapy. It was a series of tapping algorithms on you. Like the therapist would have you tap at certain parts of your face and arms and stuff to break these perturbations in your thought fields. And of course, there's no physics evidence for these thought fields. But a lot of people went there, and actually to train to become a licensed TFT therapist, what do you think the cost was, Brett?
$25,000.
Times four.
Oh, wow. But people are into these alternatives, right? Like when something new comes along and they say, I mean, even things that are far more far-fetched than what we're talking about here, they say, no, it's crystals. It's crystal therapy, you know? That excites people.
Yeah. And you get this other one. It may be true for you, but it's not true for me, and vice versa. So the N equals one experiments. That's really popular in the sort of paleo realm. We go with what we feel when we eat certain foods rather than what maybe the research bears out in the oftentimes epidemiological studies, which have their own set of confounders and biases and stuff. But it's really hard to control for confirmation bias when you're involved in your own study on yourself. You know, you haven't blinded anything there. So,
speaking of confirmation bias, somebody writes, current science seems to have an agenda which makes it unscientific. It concerns itself with control and soft and hard killing in large part. Not sure what that second part means, but the first part is interesting. Current science seems to have an agenda which makes it unscientific. So with respect to confirmation bias, if people decide what they want to find when they set out in that process, that is, I would say, definitively unscientific.
Sure. Yeah. What is science?
Well, a good place to start would be the scientific method.
Yeah. And the agenda of science is to understand reality in a comprehensible, logical way.
Yeah.
At least that's what it ought to be. Now, since it's largely funded by the government and skewed through regulations and stuff, that's, you know, oftentimes forgotten.
I didn't want to forget when you were running down the list of silly things that had received funding before. Telekinesis.
Mm-hmm.
Can we kill animals by looking at them? I know that was the title of a popular movie in the last few years, but that was a real thing. And I think that, you know, the intelligence community and the science that goes with it is very insular. You have strange people hanging out with other strange people doing strange things. Mind control, experiments in mind control, you could say that was, you know, if you assess the modern state of the world and the public discourse, you could say oh, that was somewhat successful, but there were things that were far more out there, like as the title of the movie, Men Who Stare at Goats, suggests. Those were real experiments in telekinesis.
Yeah. Yeah, there's this yearning to find out something about reality or the human brain that we haven't quite found out yet. And that book that I mentioned earlier by Kurzweil, How to Create a Mind, I think that's his latest book. So he's always been about reverse engineering the human brain to figure out what makes it tick. How does consciousness arise from neurons and or neuronal activity? And then instantiate that in a different substrate, you know?
Right.
In a computer chip, for instance. There's lots of conjecture and speculation in that realm, but it gets back to, okay, so we've got to start with what we know, and then we work from there. And you don't know what you don't know, obviously, so it just takes a scientifically rigorous perspective to make sure you channel your efforts in realms that are hopefully going to prove fruitful.
What are your closing thoughts, and what should be the takeaway for people, Wes?
Well, I guess it's the fallacy to rule them all, because it's asking us to abandon our own ability to comprehend things in a logical way, in a non-contradictory way. So when people say, you can't know truth, absolutely, or for certain, there's no certainty, when there's no objectivity, that's a myth. I mean, they're trying to declare something in an objective fashion, right? So it's hard to see it sometimes when you've been so immersed in the language and how people use language to control minds and to subvert critical thinking. So just paying attention to maybe what you're feeling in the midst of these conversations. If something doesn't feel quite right, maybe ask for some more explanation, see where it goes, and define the terms. What do you mean by objectivity when you say there's no such thing as it? And that probably will provide a lot more clarity.